Welcome to the Heart of Show Business. I am your host, Alexia Melocchi. I believe in great storytelling and that every successful artist has a deep desire to express something from the heart to create a ripple effect in our society. Emotion and entertainment are closely tied together. My guests and I want to give you insider access to how the film, television, and music industry works. We will cover dreams come true, the road less traveled, journey beginnings, and a lot of insight and inspiration in between. I am a successful film and television entrepreneur who came to America as a teenager to pursue my show business dreams. Are you ready for some unfiltered real talk with entertainment visionaries from all over the world? Then let's roll sound and action. Well, hello to all my listeners of the Heart of Show Business. I have such an incredible treat with me today. I'm being joined by, first of all, a fellow Greek. So that's always a special moment because, of course, we're probably going to cuss out in Greek. I don't know. We might surprise or we might talk about other stuff. But I also have someone who loves cats like I do. So, you know, whenever a man loves a cat, you know, they're truly special souls. I mean, hello, Freddie Mercury. He had like about 15 of them or maybe less, but somewhere around that number. So it's important to know that when a man loves cats, it's a special soul. And Evan Spiliotopoulos here is a very special soul. He is a very in-demand screenwriter who has been writing nonstop since the late 90s. He hails from Greece, kind of like me a little bit, worked with every major studio, started out in animation, wrote for Disney Toon Studios, wonderful little children stuff like The Little Mermaid 3 and the Tinkerbell and the Finding Some Treasure or something. I know I'm chopping everything. And then he went on to write Snow White and the Huntsman, and that got greenlit. And then he ended up writing the sequel. And of course, Circulus with The Rock. Very different people.
See, that would have been an interesting movie. That would have been a very interesting movie with Chris Rock.
See, spoken like a true writer. We're making a movie here as we speak. We're coming up with script ideas, people. That's going to be awesome. And then, of course, Beauty and the Beast, which I personally loved and watched a gazillion times. And then he kind of twisted on me. And now he's writing genre stuff and horror stuff. So I'm very curious to get in his head and find out, how does a man go from animation to major action fairy tale fantasy to horror? So let's get right to it. Evan, welcome to my show.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. So do tell me your secret. Why are you going into different genres?
Well, actually, very recently, the wonderful writer Craig Mazin, who co-wrote The Huntsman with me, the sequel to Snow White and the Huntsman, has received a ton of acclaim for writing the two great HBO shows, Chernobyl and now The Last of Us. And Craig started off in comedies, like the superhero comedy, the sequels to The Hangover, not the original one, but the sequels. And a lot of people now are standing back and going, oh my God, what a pivot. How do you go from all these kind of like complete slapsticky comedies to these two really serious, really emotional shows? And the answer is you cannot typecast writers. I mean, even Stephen King, one of his most wonderful books is a baseball drama. And you can pick a genre that you love, like I love fairy tales, but that doesn't mean we can't write action, horror, fantasy, period pieces, dramas, or all that. What it comes down to is a writer writes about characters. The canvas, it could be anything, as long as you have a character that you really believe in, really love, and really feel like you've developed.
That is such a great answer, and you read my mind. I do believe that characters are more important than the story, because you could have a great story that if it has no characters, I don't think you're going to get invested in it. And I would also add, and you can tell me, because obviously you know better than I do, but it's also about themes, right? So I spoke with another writer, well-known writer who was on my show, and he says, you know, you want to start with, this is a story about a man or a woman who, and you want to go and draw to common themes. And I would think that even in horror, I hope, although I don't watch a lot of it, there's got to be some character work going in there, right?
Oh, if it's good, if it's great horror, absolutely. I mean, Hereditary is a character piece. The Exorcist is absolutely a character piece, both for the Greek priest played by Jason Miller in 1973 and Ellen Burstyn and her daughter. It's the only way horror becomes relatable and frightening and engaging is if you care about the characters and you relate and recognize the characters. By the way, a really quick point, the writer that you were mentioning is absolutely right, but character is plot. So the idea is that if you're following a character under a set of circumstances that provide the theme, the story is going to be around that person's experiences. So even if it's James Bond with eight set pieces, you're still following a character on a journey.
Wow. I hadn't thought of it this way. That is, okay, people, you're just having the gift of a masterclass here. So please clean up your ears real well, because there's going to be lots more where that comes from.
No, that's all.
Even smart. Yeah, I'm sure you have more tricks on under your hat that you're wearing right now. So we'll come up. We'll squeeze your brain a little more. Trust me, I'm going to get down and dirty with you, not in a bad way, but not in a bad way. But so how does a nice boy from Greece who comes from Greece and goes into America, and we all know, you know, old school families. I mean, you say, mom, dad, I want to be a writer. Do they say, are you nuts? Are you crazy? What do they say, the parents?
Well, the circumstances are a little bit particular, because by the time I hit graduated high school, I had lost my dad. So, and mom was American. So I wanted to come to the United States to study. And so she was absolutely supportive of that. And I think that made a very big difference for me, obviously, because a lot of young people in Greece want to leave the country, but can't because of family circumstances, because it's expensive, because it's a risk. And what kind of career are you really going to pursue? And I have to say up front that I was in a unique position where my mom was fully supportive. So I moved to the States, and in my undergraduate years, I just fell in love with film. I mean, I was always, from a little kid, in love with film, but I fell in love with film studies. So I actually got a degree, an undergraduate degree in film theory, which is very surprisingly helpful, because what film theory is, you watch a ton of movies going back to the silent era. And that gives you a context of how this art form has evolved and how stories are told that a lot of people who just think the movies began with Star Wars don't understand. Then I went to Washington, D.C. to American University and got a master's degree in screenwriting, which I will say, no knock on the university, which is a good one. Screenwriting master's degree is completely useless. All you have to do is download the American Film Institute's top 100 screenplays of all time, read them, and you've saved your money and you've gotten an education in how to write screenplays. And then I moved to LA, and I was lucky enough that my writing samples got me assignments, and it all kind of started happening.
I am so loving what you're saying. First of all, because A, some of my interns are Chapman University kids, and at Chapman, they do exactly that. They do teach old school film, like old Hollywood movies. And so sometimes I see them do coverage for me and they reference movies. I'm like, how do they even know about that? Right. And then second, I've seen graduates from top film schools send me screenplays. And I cannot even believe after 4 years and maybe $500,000 later, they don't even know the basics. And I'm a huge advocate of like, download all the scripts that get nominated, download the box office hits. I'm sure there is a formula there, right? That's why they got greenlit, because Hollywood is formula.
It is formula. It absolutely is. But of course, the challenge and the creative aspect of it is, how do you take something that is a formula and make it feel fresh and new and break the formula and restructure it and use it to your advantage in a surprising way? That's the challenge.
Yeah, yeah, that is correct. But so, obviously, every writer that I know is struggling to get represented, to have a manager, an agent of sorts. Did you have to first get your first writing assignment or script sale on your own, and then you got represented? Or were you lucky enough to get somebody on your corner early on?
Excellent question. And I have the magic answer. The magic answer is you get a lawyer. You get an entertainment lawyer, because you're going to need an entertainment lawyer. And an entertainment lawyer isn't There is no screening process. Like, the agent and the manager are going to look at you and scrutinize you and read your writing samples, and rightly so. And if you're not a name and if you're just starting out, you have to really blow their socks off. An entertainment lawyer won't do any of those things. You're just going to hire them and they're going to work for you, you know, project by project. But they know agents and managers. And so they're going to say, you know, great, I can do your deals and I can do the little simple option agreements because you're a baby writer and all you're going to get is option agreements. The likelihood of selling $1 million spec screenplay is astronomical. And if it happens, you're going to get an agent and manager the next hour. So you get an entertainment lawyer and your lawyer's impressed by you and he's going to start hooking you up with these people. And that's exactly what happened to me.
That is great, because I also feel you sometimes a mentor, sometimes a producer who champions you, you know, who introduces you to people. Sometimes a lawyer can actually get a lot further than agents of managers. I've had A-list directors and writers who sometimes their own agents, they don't return the calls. So unless I'm making them a lot of money on a steady basis, right? Did you find, because again, the career of a writer is obviously one where you have to have a lot of passion and do a lot of sacrifice, because you're not necessarily going to be a millionaire overnight, just like you said it. So were you supporting yourself with writing assignments? Was that the thing that was basically helping you continue writing the things that you care about the most? And what do you care about the most too, while I have you? It's a two-pronged question, because yeah, what kind of stories do you want to tell?
Well, so first of all, absolutely. The first prong is my assignments supported me as a writer. But I have to tell you, I moved to LA 95, and I had the good fortune right away of getting two sci-fi channel movies. At the time when they were doing the Monster of the Month, I think it was, where they were basically doing like $500,000 to at the most $1 million. And that was about it. And the movies are awful, but you got your IMDb credit, you padded the resume, and you got to produce screenplay, and that makes you look good. However, it reached a point when those movies don't support you, don't feed you really. No. And it reached a point when I had, I think, $3,000 in my bank account, which to live in LA at the time, back in the late 90s, was maybe squeezing it 3 months of life. And so I was already starting to figure out, okay, I'm not going back, but what kind of part-time job can I get that will also help me, give me the time to write, when Disney hired me? And that changed everything. Like, that was it. Like, the knife was at my throat. And then Disney put me on staff at Disney Toons to write animated movies. And that paycheck not only supported me, that paycheck, like, could, 1 year could have lasted 3-4 years. And then I was at Disney for 8 years. And at that point, once Disney approves you, even if it's Disney Toons, you're in. I mean, a studio that massive has given you its stamp. Now you're okay to be known to other studios. So that was that aspect of it. The second one was what projects interest me. So the thing is, there isn't a specific, I wish I could tell you, boy, I always wanted to do the story of Jane Eyre. There's not that. There's not a particular theme or project or concept that hooks me. It's always character. It's always character. I mean, you know, when this horror movie that I did, The Unholy, that I directed, my first movie during the pandemic, what I loved about it was that it was about a broken journalist who was caught in his earlier in his career fabricating stories, and it ruins him and it throws him down to National Enquirer type levels. And then he finds these real miracles, he believes, that are going to resurrect his career and put him on the map again. And then he discovers that he's opened Pandora's box. In order to shut it, he has to destroy himself. And for me, that was an interesting character. That was a huge journey. So it just always goes back to character. I wish I could say it was something more like completely specific, like I love murder mysteries. That's too general. It's character.
I know. They always ask me too, because sometimes they go, oh, you know, you're Greek or you're European. Maybe you just like art house stuff or epics or historical. And I said, no, I will watch, you know, an action adventure. I rewatch a rom-com as long as I'm invested in the journeys and the world. It's something I haven't seen before, an angle to something that I haven't seen before. So you directed The Unholy, correct?
Correct.
What was it like go from writing to directing? Was it a big scary thing or?
Terrifying. It was terrifying. And I didn't want to do it. It was just circumstances that landed in. It's the funniest thing, because when you speak to 10 people in LA, 9 of them will say, I want to direct. I'm the 10th one. And it just happened that there was a book by a late great English horror novelist named James Herbert that I read when I was 13 years old. We won't say when, but when I was 13 years old. And I, at the time, was in Greece, obviously, growing up, and I knew this was a movie. I just felt this was a movie. And I was already a film buff, so I felt it was Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole meets The Exorcist. So as I entered the film business and my name started getting stronger and stronger, my career started taking off, I would go around to the studios that liked me and basically ask them to adopt this orphan child for me to write. And finally, Screen Gems, which is the genre division of Sony, in 2019, jumped aboard, but they had an edict of hiring A-list writers, I'm making air quotes with my fingers, who never have directed, who wanted to direct, surround them with a team that could help them filmically tell a story because we just know how to tell it on paper, and give them that shot. And so my entire team basically said yes for me. So they threw me off the deep end. And what got me through it was Sam Raimi was our producer. And Sam's awesome, and he held my hand, and so we got through it. But the thing that I have to underline is we shot it during the pandemic, not intentionally, obviously. So we started shooting in February of 2020. We were supposed to shoot for 7 weeks. We shut down on week four. All of us came home. We edited remotely the footage that we had, waited until mid-September when Massachusetts opened up again with very strict regulations, went back, and then faced the absolute nightmare of having to shoot during those regulations, which was, by the way, totally understandable because they were for our own safety. And I only use the term nightmare in terms of production nightmare. But it was basically like you couldn't have more than 9 extras in a room and they couldn't be sitting next to each other. And we had a funeral scene to film. So we had to get a second unit to shoot those 9 extras 100 times, dress them in different clothes, move them to different parts of the church. And then when we assembled it, these 9 extras are the entire congregation. And of course, there were the physical things of, I was in like a hazmat suit the whole time. And September in Massachusetts is no longer, you know, fall, it's summer. And so we went from shooting in -1 temperatures to shooting in like 100 degree temperatures. And I swear I was lobster red every single day. And you couldn't approach the actors because they were the vulnerable ones because they didn't wear masks, obviously. And
probably your glasses were fogging up all the time.
Oh, my God. It was crazy. Yeah. They finally got me like these special goggles where I could wear the glasses that didn't fog. They didn't work. They fogged, maybe slightly less.
That is insane. You remind me of a friend of mine who was TV producer, and they were doing series right after the pandemic, but during strict restrictions in Canada. And he's been used all his life to be a producer on set, where he goes on set and he couldn't do it. He had to basically stay in a hotel like all day, and they would just be doing Zooms just like that. And he couldn't even step on the set to say hello, introduce himself to the actors, see if anybody needed any help. It's been quite a challenge. And I know some filmmakers who would just get a ranch somewhere in the middle of nowhere and get 10 of their friends. And then they would quarantine themselves for like a week. And then they would all work the cameras and the crew and the acting and do it all. And they made movies. Because I feel that's the beauty of creativity. I think artists, they always want to create. And they will find a way, even during the pandemic. Clearly. Talk to me a little bit about the studio system. Everybody has read the horror stories. I've had a few guests on my show, like Titoff, who did Catwoman back in the day with Halle Berry, and he was telling me the nightmare of that. Obviously, is it still applicable what they say, that when you work with a studio, you have to get like 100 sets of notes from 100 different executives, and it's like changing every 2 minutes? Or is a little bit more under control right now?
I will tell you this. It is absolutely 100 sets of notes from 100 different executives, but I've never felt that was necessarily an awful experience because I haven't been in a situation where the notes are insane. And I'm sure that happens. I just haven't seen it. So, you know, in the studio level, when 50, 100, 150, 200, $250 million are at play, there is a large degree of scrutiny. And here's the quid pro quo of studio versus indie. In studio world, they will be breathing down your neck. I like to say the eye of Sauron would be upon you at any given time. In the indie world, you have mostly total freedom to do whatever you want. However, the alternative is the studio is going to make your movie go theatrical, and your movie's going to be seen, and your movie's going to get a good streaming deal, and your movie's going to get all these other perks and good publicity and all that kind of stuff. In the independent world, there is a pretty good chance your movie will never be seen by anyone ever.
Yeah.
So those are the two aspects that you got to keep in mind. Now, the only thing that I can tell you up front is problematic with the studio system is there's a lot of writers on a movie, and that creates very many times a complete writing by committee situation. I mean, the worst one I've ever seen was, you know, Charlie's Angels, that Elizabeth Banks did a great job directing. But at the end of the day, when I saw how many writers had worked on it, we were a soccer team plus substitutes, and it was kind of crazy.
Yeah. Wow. I feel that there's got to be some conflict for sure, and there's multiple writers. And I'm sure it also has to do within the writers, because who gets the first credit? Who gets second in command? Who gets the shared card? Who gets the most money? You know, there's always this thing now, even as you know, with television, with whether it's called the showrunner writer. You know, sometimes you may have a great TV pilot written by a relatively unknown writer who will not see the light of day unless a showrunner writer comes on board. And many times that showrunner writer will basically trash that script and rewrite completely ex novo. And this is something I try to explain to some of my clients. You have to be willing sometimes to give up that credit and become created by, have it be then the next Lost, the next Walking Dead, so that people can say from the creators of. And that's really what truly matters, is to be the creator. I feel creator is so much more important than screenwriter, don't you think?
Well, for television, I would assume certainly. Now, I will say that I actually haven't dabbled in television. There are a couple of deals that I do have right now, which if they happen, will be my first. But so it sounds like you're absolutely right. It's not my world yet.
Got it. What happens when you have you ever pitched a story of yours that they say, great, we want to take the story, but we want to have somebody else write it, or it's never happened to you?
That has not. I'll tell you why, though. It's because by the time I was in the position to go into studios and pitch my stories, I already had a name. So there would be no point in swapping me out, because they would only swap me out with someone of my own level. But I definitely have heard of baby writers. I can think of three situations off the top of my head that went in, pitched a story, sold it, got paid $250,000, never got a chance to write it, but they got paid.
Wow. Yeah. It does happen. How is the optioning market look like from your perspective? Because obviously I see things as a producer. Are scripts getting optioned anymore, or is it a different landscape?
I have not optioned anything in over a decade and a half. Options is usually where you go when you're a baby writer and it's not a studio that's involved. It's a producer who likes your script and wants to take a crack at it. And producers, you know, they'll claim, and sometimes they'll be right, that they don't have they certainly don't have the finances of a studio. But I always get a little bit annoyed when I hear, oh, they can't afford $5,000 for a year option. They can't afford $2,500 for a year option. And it's usually like, oh, we'll take it on for free or for a dollar. That's bullshit. That's not right. But to option a script, that's usually the context that I see it at. I've never seen a studio say, we'll option something. A studio will option a book when they've got a deal going on, and they won't just buy the book outright. They'll option a book because they'll have a writer who did a take. And then if the writer's script is great and you get the movie made, then they exercise the option in the book. But I've never heard of them optioning a script. That's a producer thing.
Got it. So will they basically hire you to write? It's like a step deal. They'll say, okay, here's this book, Evan, we want you to take a stab at it, write a first draft or whatever. And then if it gets greenlit, then it will be a different deal. But they fully pay you your fee as a writer, you know, on the writing of the script versus the optioning. So they own the IP, or will you own the IP? Who owns the IP in that case?
Well, if it's a novel, the novelist will own the IP until the option gets exercised. So they'll get paid whatever they get paid to put their script on the to put their book on the shelf for the studio to a green light to develop a screenplay. And then if the screenplay gets greenlit and it's getting made, the studio will then exercise their option fully by the book, in which case now they own the IP. But if the film doesn't get made, the option expires, the IP reverts back to the creator, who is the novelist.
Got it.
Script option, same thing with the script option. I mean, if you've optioned a script to producer for however long and whatever amount of money, when that option expires unexercised, you own your script.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. No, because I had a well-known director who passed away recently, but he had a lot of things with the studio that was set up. And then he, even though they did nothing with that intellectual property, he couldn't get it back because he had to pay obscene amount of money, because then there were all this extra cost of the studio for him to get the rights back. And so I was always saying, you know, make sure whether it's a script, a book or whatever, that you are relatively certain that it will happen within a certain amount of time, because otherwise you're just going to be stuck with something on the shelf, like you said, forever. And then what's that going to do to you as a writer? Not to you, Evan, obviously, but to anyone.
Sure. But I think he was probably referring to the concept of turnaround, where let's say a studio has optioned a book and paid, let's say, 15 grand. More probably if it's a studio, but let's say 15 grand. And then they hired a writer to write a script for 250 grand. And they hired another writer to write for 150 grand. So, and they didn't make the movie. So now it's got this negative cost of $400,000 for the writers plus $15,000, let's say, for the novelist. It reverts back to the novelist. The novelist can do whatever they want. But there, if one of the scripts was good and the writer and producer wanted to take it around the studio, the other studio have to pay turnaround. That's not the novelist's problem. If it's a book, that person can take it wherever they want, and the studio that paid all that money is out of luck.
Exactly.
But if it's a script, no.
Exactly. And I preface, I already know that stuff, but I like asking that to you because I want my listeners to hear it from the person who's actually the expert and does that all day long. Have you ever had a situation as a writer, because I get that a lot, and I hear that a lot, where you come up with a movie idea, with a script idea, and 3 months later, somebody else writes nearly the identical same thing. Obviously not your words, but something very, very similar. How do you protect yourself from that? Because I've had writers that go, oh my gosh, I wrote a similar story to this and I registered at the WGA. I can sue because it's similar, blah, blah, blah. It's a similar title. How do you do that? I mean, does that piss you off if you're coming up with something, then someone else does it in a different, slightly way, but similar?
Yeah, I mean, it pisses me off in terms of the work that I did. But there is something called the collective subconscious, which is the stuff that inspires you to write that particular screenplay. Other people are watching at the same time. Other people are absorbing that at the same time. So before you get upset of, I got robbed, you have to be sure that there was a chain of contact where this other person who wrote a similar thing was somehow exposed to your idea or exposed to your script. You can't, you can sue for whatever reason, but you can't really hope to win anything unless you can prove that you got robbed. Name a movie, name any movie.
I can tell you of a personal situation. We had one of our clients write a movie on Blackbeard. And then we literally pitched it at Parks McDonald. And 3 months later, Black Sails got greenlit. And they're like, we really love the script, but we're not so crazy about the writer. We love the idea. Again, you know, it's, and then the writer got upset because it's like, wait a minute, they didn't want to do me. But then all of a sudden they probably got the idea. Oh, this sounds really cool, but we don't need this. Why don't we make it in Sear and we hire someone known to do the series, right? So again, speaking of personal experience, and then how do you explain it to them? Because there is a coincidence that we did pitch that project about that character. And then coincidentally, 3 months later, something else gets done is a series. And I've had that even on the series on Catherine de' Medici. We had a Canadian client who wrote something called The Serpent Queen. And it was a Catherine de' Medici story and series. And then the same network that is doing it had seen that project. You know, you go,
Yeah, that's awkward as hell, because you do you've got a clear contact point where you brought that project to a specific group of people that then turned around and made a similar project. I was hoping that you were talking about, oh, I pitched to HBO and then New Line or Canal Plus in France made it. That's a little awkward.
Yeah, and of course, for example, in that one, it's books, and I think that's why many people like reverting back to what you said about books. I think my God, and maybe you can tell me, but many people are working with books because there is a better protection. Because then they can say, well, there are like 5 books on Catherine Demetrius. There are 10 books on Blackbeard with 10 different interpretation or Hercules, right? So how are you gonna go and sue me because I could have taken inspiration from that book that I have the rights to, right? So it becomes an adaptation to a book. So I feel that people are doing a lot more pre-existing IP, whether it's a comic book, a short story, a remake, because it adds a level of protection. Have you found that to be true?
I think it definitely adds a layer of protection, but I think the 80% reason that they're doing that is because that pre-existing IP already comes with a core group of fans and has had some publicity. Even if it's not Harry Potter, it's had some publicity that then the studio can glom onto. So I think it's 80%. Oh, good. We have a popular book called The Serpent Queen that then we can turn into a TV series that critics have already reviewed, and there's some basis for it. And the other 20% is if somebody sues us for stealing Catherine de' Medici story, we throw the Serpent Queen at their heads.
Exactly. Or some other book or whatever that it was inspired from. No,
Well,
but it's.
that's the problem when it's a real life public domain characters that lived, 200, 300, 400 years ago. I mean, your story has to have inventions of your own that then the other company uses, unless it's a thoroughly original story about, space aliens meeting the president. And then you're like, wait, this is not public domain. You took that story.
And I love what you said about collective consciousness, because I mean, as you were telling me the story of the unholy, and I haven't seen that. I don't know if it's come out yet or it has to. Did it come out yet?
It came
No.
out in 21, yeah.
Oh, okay. See, pandemic brain. I'm sort of like so behind on stuff. I started Netflix binging. Netflix is to blame, and all the stupid series that I'm watching nonstop because that's kind of like how I tune out. But so. Yeah, now you're telling me the story of the unholy, and then I'm thinking about a client of mine from Canada who wrote a very, very similar, not story, character journey premise, not the story in any way. And I'm going, gosh, see, that didn't get made, but Evan's stuff got made. But then, of course, you're Evan, and it's a little different,
Oh, I
So.
have plenty of story for you. I was a presenter 2 years ago, 21, at the Burbank International Film Festival, and I was the screenplay award presenter. And they give an original and adapted screenplay for unproduced screenplay. So it's kind of a way to get new writers out into the open. And I give the adapted screenplay award, and the writer's not there to receive it. I'm like, well, it's funny because they were there last night when my movie, The Unholy, screened. And later on, I'm talking to one of the festival organizers. They tell me what his script is about, and it's the faith-based version of The Unholy. It's a failed journalist finds a miracle in a small town, only minus satanic and bad things happen, where theirs was, oh, he resurrects his faith. And I'm like, well, this poor soul went and saw my movie the
Oh
night before and
my
probably went home
God.
and hung himself.
Poor baby. Oh, David Castaldo, are you listening? He's one of my writers. Oh,
True.
this is so crazy. Well, speaking of speaking engagements and you participating to the festivals, both you and I think you're also on the board like me of the LA Greek Film Festival, or if
I think
not, you're on the board.
everybody with a Greek last name is on the board of the LA
Well,
Greek Film Festival.
but I take pride that I was one of the first together
Okay.
with Jim Janot the first year. So, but I
Good.
love it because we're both like very active in our communities. And obviously, it's a very difficult career to undertake for a writer who's not based in the US, say a Greek writer, an Italian writer. What are you trying to do, and how do you think the industry can help to discover the future of storytellers that are not necessarily privileged like you and I are to live in the United States? How do they get those shots?
It's, I think the festivals that read unproduced screenplays are critical. I think there's, of course, a lot of competitions. It's easy to say that. The thing is, it would be great if there were a lot more places that specifically unproduced writers from around the world can send their material to. But here's something that we have to stress. I've read a lot of English language screenplays by non-English language writers. The 99.999 into infinity majority of them reek. They're terrible. And they're terrible because you better be sure when you're writing in a language that's not your first language, you've mastered it completely. Otherwise, it's going to sound translated, and that's not a screenplay. So it's one thing to talk about unproduced writers in the U.S. who absolutely need more venues for their material to get seen, as opposed to this tortuous game of Russian roulette where you're trying to approach agents, but you can't get an agent unless you got a sale, and you can't get a sale without an agent. And don't forget, agents have only so much bandwidth to read new writers' material. They've already got their clients, and most of them have more clients than they know what to do with. So it's a very, very bad way of getting our hands on great stuff. And you're always hoping that, well, the festival circuit and the readers and all that, the good material will float. But how many good writers get disillusioned right off the bat? If you start talking about writers of the non-English language, we're talking about countries necessarily, forget Europe, which has a functioning film industry. We're talking about the rest of the world that doesn't. So if you're a writer in, look, Egypt, which has a rudimentary film industry, how are you going to get your voice heard? Talk about Greece. Look, Greece, unfortunately, we know very well, is an old boys network. And for a new writer to break in, they have to jump through any number of hoops that have nothing to do with writing in order to get their script in the right hands.
Yeah,
that's the issue. If it's about non-English language writers being read in the United States, I'm not even sure I'm for that because of all the scripts I've read.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's interesting that you said that because I feel Italy was like that as well. You know, you couldn't get anything greenlit or sold or written unless it was done with a political message about the society and the culture. And it was very sort of art house. So it didn't really have a commercial value. And if it did, they would shut it down. They would not open the doors to those storytellers. Now it's changed a lot, you know, and I feel like Greece is changing a lot. We have so many movies that are, you know, have candidates for Oscars nominations and look at, you know, oh my God, I'm having a blank now. The director from The Lobster.
Lanthimos.
Yorgos Lanthimos. Hello, thank you very much. You know, that he does something that is very weird and very different. And it's not necessarily labeled as a Greek, typical Greek thing, but that's how he broke the things. And I love that you are getting so involved. I know that you're part of the Hellenic Initiative and you're getting involved in that. So I hope that there will be more people like yourself and me, that they will create groups where they can foster those new voices, where they can show them how to do to have use Final Draft or Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, who is right, which is a Bible, not get so mugged up into the technique of it, but really learn what sells, right?
I got to plug my own favorite one. When I was at American University, one of our textbooks was Vicki King's How to Write a Screenplay in 31 Days. It is invaluable to me because I cannot tell you how many young writers I've met who've been working on one script for the last 2 years. And I recognize the quality of rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, but part of getting hired in the film business is being fast and delivering within a very specific amount of time. Now, again, I don't work in television, but I think television is particularly fast. But even in features, you got to be able to hit your targets and turn the thing around quickly. People appreciate speed. And that book taught me how to write fast. I think a lot of my career has come out of the fact that I can turn things around quickly.
That is such a great advice. I'm going to actually drop it in the show notes. I have not read that book. Of course, I live and breathe Blake Snyder, Save the Cat. And there is another book that I love, which is Your Screenplay Sucks, 100 Ways to Make it Great. And it basically, for the newbie writers, go over the 100 most obvious mistakes that people make, you know. Sure. But it's very simple. Right. And so it just teaches you the technique. This has been such a great conversation. I feel like it's literally been a masterclass on screenwriting. I can't wait to share this with my audience, Evan. And what are you working on next? Is there something that you can announce or share without it being breaking confidentiality things?
Yeah, no, I think, well, the only reason I hesitate, but I will tell you, is because, as we said earlier, multiple writers can be in a movie, and until the credit is decided, it's always a little awkward to say, hey, this is what I've got coming out, and all of a sudden, oops, it's not. But the next project I at least worked on is a horror movie again, called The Pope's Exorcist with Russell Crowe, that's coming out on April 7th, which is based on the true story of Father Gabriel Amorth, who was the Vatican's in-house exorcist for 35 years. co-starring Franco Nero as the Pope. So,
oh, wow.
Yes, that's the next thing that's actually coming out. And among the other many projects I'm working on is, I'm going to mention one of the TV things. As you know, AMC is now doing Interview the Vampire.
Yes.
I'm working on the fifth book of the Vampire Chronicles series, Memnock the Devil, which we're hoping to create as a mini series because the book is a self-contained tale. It doesn't follow the continuous narrative chronology. So we're hoping to create that as a mini series for Lestat.
Wow, the Vampire Lestat. Oh gosh. I have to say you are extremely prolific. Now I have to like put that in my to-do list to see the Russell Crowe film when it comes out, because of course it deals with Italy and I'm half Italian, as you know. So it's hard sometimes. It's a struggle, Evangelos, because I'm half Greek, half Italian. Who do I root for? Can I root for both people? Yes, I can.
Can I tell you, I did a DNA test thing at one point recently, yeah. And I thought I was going to be like 99% Greek. I'm actually 60% Greek and 30% Italian. And the whole, I don't, and they found my, the ancestor who gave me the Italian part was a guy who left Greece under the name Bastardi, which tells you everything, I think.
Oh, it's like the ending to this podcast. Look it up, people. Bastardini, look it up. It's there is a little something here to be said.
There,
but
yes.
No, you're certainly not that in personality. You're wonderful. You're a wonderful human being, and thank you for sharing all your gifts and all your knowledge. It's truly appreciated. Leaving it up and closing it up to this wonderful podcast. How do you define Evangelos in three words?
You know, I was going to say chocolate, chocolate, chocolate. We discussed it, but then you introduced me with I'm a treat, and I'm going to go with that.
Ooh, and I like that because you know what? You broke the rules. You could have said three different words, but you actually put it together into one sentence made of three words. You certainly are a treat. You've been a treat in this podcast. I absolutely loved having you on. For all my listeners, if you got questions, of course, you're going to follow. You can watch all of Evan's movie, especially The Unholy, which I'm going to make sure I watch it because I kind of don't like horror, but I'm going to watch it because I just produced the horror myself, so I better, called Dark Parasite. And I, you know, I'll put in all his links and please review, give 10-star ratings to all his movies and let's bring him back maybe to give us some more insight. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Evan, for coming on my show.
My pleasure. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Heart of Show Business. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend. You can also subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcast player. If you have any questions or comments or feedback for us, you can reach me directly at theheartofshowbusiness.com.